Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Versus History Podcast as we approach episode 150 in podcast years. That's a lot. It's me, Patrick O'Shaughnessy at History Chappie on social media. And today we are absolutely delighted to be joined by Dr. Claire Jackson, who is the senior tutor of Trinity Hall, the University of Cambridge. And for those of you I teach, many of you entered the Robson History Prize offered by Trinity College at the University of Cambridge. And more importantly still, I guess, Claire, we're here to talk to you all about your brand new book entitled Devil Land, England Under Siege, 1588 to 1688. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And thank you very much for having me.
Oh, the pleasure really is absolutely ours. And congratulations on being nominated for the Wolfson History Prize 2022. That's pretty big by anybody's book. So congratulations for that. And could you tell us a little bit about you and your background, academic or otherwise, just to get the proverbial ball rolling?
So I'm, as you said, senior tutor of Trinity Hall in Cambridge. I'm in the history faculty. I probably started my interests in the 17th century, both when I was an undergraduate and as a postgraduate, thinking about 17th century Britain very much as a multiple monarchy and a multinational state. I was interested initially in the relations between England, Ireland and Scotland, thinking about this as a sort of century where these independent nations were ruled by the same ruler but remained independent. And a lot of my early work was on the interactions between 17th century England, Scotland and Ireland, often things like legal history and sort of asymmetries and alignments. And then I wrote and sort of presented five films for the BBC about 2014, 2015 called The Stuarts, which was really looking at the Stuarts as a dynasty from that multiple monarchy perspective. It was transmitted just before the Scottish independence referendum of 2014. That was really the sort of background to it. But then we later made a second series, The Stuarts in Exile, which took the story on to about the 1750s, 1760s to look at, again, the sort of combination of geopolitics and dynastic history. And it was very much in the process of sort of thinking about and then recording and then reflecting afterwards those films that I really began to rethink the 17th century and think very much about how 17th century England in particular appeared primarily to its continental neighbours, but also to its British neighbours, sort of Scotland and Ireland. And in some ways, Devil Land, perhaps belatedly, but Devil Land, England Under Siege, 1588, 1688, is really the book that came out of making those television films. It really wants to try and see ourselves, if we're thinking about 17th century England, to try and see ourselves as others see us.
That's fantastic. I think you've answered my next question about the historical genesis of the book. So I'll just flip reverse it and ask you a different one. Why did you pick the years 1588 to 1688 as the chronological trajectory? Over to you.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I think the way in which we periodize the history we study can often, even unconsciously, shape the questions we ask. In this instance, though, I really saw a real symmetry between 1588. So the book opens with Elizabeth I ordering the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots in 1587. But it opens as this sort of dramatic moment with the Spanish Armada, a failed attempt at a seaborne invasion of the British Isles by Philip II of Spain. And it concludes with another seaborne invasion, that of William of Orange, exactly 100 years later in 1688. And this one was more successful, although we tend to, or at least historiography has subsequently sort of recast it as an invitation and not really an invasion. But I think if you'd been standing on the Devon shores in 1688 and you'd seen the numbers of warships and the numbers of soldiers sent over, you might have rethought
absolutely
the idea that this was some sort of peaceful delegation. And I think, you know, sort of bookending that century with these two seaborne invasions and captures quite a lot of the themes of the book, which is a sort of an attempt to bring together again geopolitics and dynastic history, sort of thinking about the Stuarts as a dynasty, a foreign dynasty imported from Scotland, and a dynasty that can't necessarily be expected always, or at least that the most of its English subjects feel can't always be securely relied upon to protect England's or promote England's interests, and how that intersects with the geopolitics of England as a relatively small state with a young Protestant church, and the fear of foreign influence or interference or even invasion really does haunt the whole century. And I think it also, the 1588 to 1688 bookending, also confirms the extent to which contemporaries did often interpret the present in light of the past. And certainly the fact that William of Orange's invasion fleet landed in Torbay on the 5th of November 1688 was seen by contemporaries as having massive sort of eschatological providential significance. The 5th of November by that stage was obviously the anniversary of the discovery of the gunpowder plot in 1605, and 1688 was exactly 100 years after the failed Spanish Armada. So the fact that a Protestant deliverer was now arriving on England's shores to free England from its Catholic monarch James VII and II was seen by contemporaries as having huge Protestant and providential significance. So yeah, the bookending of that century is very deliberate.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jackson. Now I have a quote for you here. These are not my words, far too clever for me, but I'll give it to you and ask you a question on the back of it. So, among foreign observers, 17th century England was known as Devil Land, a diabolical country of fallen angels, torn apart by rebellion, religious extremism, and royal collapse. I guess the idea of Devil Land may also extend to some of Britain's domestically homegrown Puritan separatists, potentially, who knows, who went over to the New World or even to Holland or to the Netherlands. Why and how so?
Sounds a bit like an exam question.
Absolutely Devil Land. It is.
The title of the book is very much taken from 17th century contemporaries. So Devil Land was the title given to England by an anonymous Dutch pamphleteer in 1652. And it was intended as a term of abuse, and it played on a medieval Latin pun whereby the English, the Angli, had been cherished as these cherubic angels, these angeli. But this Dutch pamphleteer in 1652 is arguing that at that stage, you should really see the English as anything but. They were fallen angels, and 3 years earlier, they had sort of outrageously executed their divinely ordained king, Charles I, in public. They'd set up a republican commonwealth, and its leaders seemed sort of defiant and unrepentant. And now, even worse, those republican leaders were now contemplating declaring war on the Dutch. So Devil Land was a term that sort of captures the extent to which foreign observers, regarded England with a mixture, 17th century England, really with a mixture of sometimes horror, sometimes sort of stupefaction. And one of the themes of the book really is the extent to which, England is remarkably unstable for much of this period. And that instability, is both quite disconcerting for its own subjects, but is both an opportunity and a threat to foreign observers. There's something also very porous about the English political nation that, whereas foreign ambassadors can't get very close to Philip II of Spain in the Spanish royal palaces, it does seem to foreign observers as though, it's very easy to get sort of quite high up, sort of access to ministers and courtiers within the Stuart court. And one of the sort of themes of the book really is trying to give a voice to the huge numbers of foreign ambassadors that are posted to London throughout the 17th century. And that does form a real contrast with the Tudor world and the sort of Elizabethan era, in which, Elizabeth hadn't maintained large diplomatic corps with many of her continental neighbours. I mean, apart from France, Elizabeth maintained no ambassador in any other Catholic country. James VI of Scotland, by contrast, had been on the throne for 20 years in Scotland before he acceded to the English throne as James I. And part of his successful campaign to succeed Elizabeth had been founded on frequent and very interactive diplomatic relations with a large number of continental European countries. So when he moved south, suddenly, London became a very popular and populous, diplomatic centre for ambassadors. So trying to record a lot of these ambassadors' perceptions, the extent to which they are often you know, frustrated, mystified, incensed by what they find in 17th century England is one of the themes of the book.
Thank you. Okay, our next question. Another quote for you. Devil Land reveals England as, in many ways, a failed state, endemically unstable and rocked by devastating events from the gunpowder plot to the Great Fire of London. So to what extent was England truly unstable during that period? And are there, just to, again, flip reverse the question, and turn it on its head, perhaps any underlying continuities or exceptions to that general rule?
I guess it might depend what you mean by truly unstable.
Absolutely,
quite a lot of this book is about perceptions. And I think I'm very clear about that in the introduction. I think I quote from a 1620s pamphlet in which the author says that, you know, some of his readers might complain that he's been looking at the world squint-eyed. And I say quite explicitly that readers of Devil Man might feel likewise that, you know, my squint-eyed view of 17th century England is very much one that emphasizes instability, contingency and precarity at the expense of perhaps buoyancy and assurance and sort of confidence. However, that's partly because and primarily because, the focus is both dynastic and diplomatic. And I think if you think about the dynastic history of late 16th and early 17th century England, it is unstable. The Stuarts come to the throne because of what I call the biological bankruptcy of the Tudors. Elizabeth I's not only failure to produce an heir, but failure to make any provision for the succession or even to allow her own subjects to discuss the succession and to actually make discussion of the succession a capital crime in the 1590s, funnily enough, results in instability. People are, very apprehensive through the 1590s about whether or not on Elizabeth's death, England might just become a bloody site for sort of war, very violent wars of succession, as continental powers have both a dynastic and a sort of confessional interest. Although the Stuarts come to the throne perhaps with more sort of remarkable ease than some commentators had feared, the same kind of succession questions resurface, say, in the late 17th century when Charles II fails to produce a legitimate heir and the succession passes to his Catholic younger brother. And I suppose, the link between dynasty and confessionalism is encapsulated clearly in something like the gunpowder plot, when one's trying to think about, get inside the minds of early 17th century gunpowder plotters, mostly men in their mid-30s, who've seen their parents' generation suffer huge penalties for their recusancy, who perhaps a lot of Catholics had high hopes of James's accession to the throne. He was, after all, the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, who has sort of assumed the posthumous status of a martyr. It's widely known that James's wife, Anna of Denmark, has covertly converted to Catholicism. Yeah, there's a lot of hope. And James also had kept on very good terms with Catholic states as King of Scotland. He'd immediately sued for peace with Spain on his accession to the English throne. And there's a lot of hope that James perhaps might convert himself. And then it becomes very clear that, he's absolutely unlikely, that he's a staunch Calvinist. And he's also not really prepared to do very much about the framework of Elizabethan legislation and recusancy penalties against Catholics. And he also has a son called Henry, his older son, Prince Henry, which for Catholics evokes bad memories of Henry VIII. And he has another son, Charles, and a daughter. And it's this recognition for Catholics, perhaps of that generation of the sort of mid-30s, that actually nothing is going to change now, that all of these hopes of a new dynasty and an end to persecution, and also the fact that Spain, that had for so long stimulated English Catholic hopes and offered an opportunity to take on the Elizabethan state. I mean, England is now an ally of James VI and I. So, that sense that something desperate has to happen, that violent action has to be taken, and from that, the gunpowder plot itself is formed. And then if you quickly fast forward to the end of the period in 1688 and the invasion I was talking about at the outset of the interview, William of Orange's, part of that is the same intersection between confessionalism and dynastic succession. Although Charles II didn't produce any legitimate heirs and his brother was the lawful successor, James VII and II's daughters, Mary and Anne, were the next successors. And a lot of people felt, well, James would just be a temporary aberration, if he lived as long as his his older brother, maybe the reign would be sort of 3 years or so, and then it would be fine because both Mary and Anne were staunch Protestants. And then in June 1688, James's second Catholic wife gives birth to a son, and suddenly Protestants aren't faced with this sort of temporary aberration of a Catholic monarch. It now seems as though there could be a Catholic monarch stretching into eternity. And again, that's really what suddenly motivates, you know, the Immortal Seven to ask William of Orange, who's married to Mary, James's older daughter, to intervene in English politics. So, you know, that connection never really goes away through the 17th century of the dynastic and confessional implications of the Stuarts. I mean, each of the Stuart monarchs is married to a Catholic consort, and that brings, you know, confessional entanglements, patronage networks, and expectations and aspirations that, you know, actually England might yet be brought back into the Catholic fold. And the broader context against which all of this is happening as well is Counter-Reformation success, that between 1590 and 1690, the amount of territory of continental Europe that is Protestant shrinks from about a half to about 20%. So, you know, being a Protestant country or a Protestant state becomes very much the minority taste, and a feeling that really the momentum has shifted to the Counter-Reformation, and whether that's Philip II's Spain at the end of the 16th century or Louis XIV's France at the end of the 17th. You know, the fragility of having a monarchy in England that looks perhaps, you know, even looks Protestant, but sort of sometimes can sound Catholic in terms of its consorts or its actions or its foreign alliances, is much of what I suppose is often called political devilry, and again speaks to the title of the book.
Thank you very much indeed. I've got to insert or interject with a question that you weren't expecting, because it's been brought up by some of the fantastic things you've been talking about. We know in the 1600s, about 10% of England's population emigrated, not solely to British North America, but largely. Is there any truth to the claim that the most unstable element in England were the Puritan separatists who largely went to America? Not everyone that went to America was clearly a Puritan separatist, obviously. Most people that went to Jamestown weren't, for instance, although many that went to the Northeast or New England during Archbishop's Lords reforms in the 1630s were. Is it not the case that England was fortuitously able to sort of lobotomize or export its most endemically unstable element, its religious separatists? Or is that erroneous?
I don't know. I think it would depend on to whom you are talking in the 17th century, as in terms of identifying which was the most sort of endemically unstable element. I mean, I think the gunpowder plotters were pretty annihilistic in what they were envisaging on behalf of the Catholic Church. However,
absolutely,
it certainly is the case. And one of the interesting things about the 17th century is the extent to which Papists and Puritans are often lumped together as people whose, you know, political aspirations for their religion are such that they pose a danger to the state. And certainly James's experience of quite hardline Presbyterians in Scotland, for the 20 years that he ruled Scotland as an adult king before he became King of England, have sort of inclined him to see Puritans very much through a Presbyterian lens. And that Presbyterian lens is one that wants to, you know, take away royal power from the church and wants to think of monarchy in terms of a sort of an elective kingship. So I think throughout the 17th century, one always has to think of the opportunities or the option of exile. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things as well about Charles II as a monarch in the Restoration is that he is somebody who spent 11 years in exile. And both whether it's sort of the New World colonies or whether it's the United Provinces, the Dutch Republic, that has religious toleration, there is always that sort of square brackets around many 17th century realities, that if you really do not like the society in which you're living, if you really find your religious beliefs being compromised to the extent where you feel that your salvation is being imperiled, you have the option of exile. Now, clearly, often you need to be of a sufficient socioeconomic means that you could migrate. But a lot of 17th century writers, commentators, political figures spend time in exile. And again, it's that slightly at one remove perspective that informs a lot of Devilland. You know, what suddenly does England look like, you know, once you're not living there? And, you know, there wasn't really room to do all this in the book, but there are really interesting, you know, stories to be told about how things like the civil wars or the interregnum or the restoration are perceived from all of the different, say, American colonies, because all of them, you know, have very different histories attached to their founding and their charters and different constellations of local political leaders. And, you know, at that stage, nobody in London, you know, has the time or bandwidth to be worrying about, you know, instant communications with every colony. And, you know, how those colonial legislatures and political establishments respond to huge turbulence at the metropole is another really interesting 17th century story.
Well, that answers that. Thank you very much, Dr. Jackson. The final question from us, another quote. Starting on the eve of the Spanish Armada in 1588 and concluding with a not-so-glorious revolution 100 years later, Devilland is a spectacular reinterpretation of England's vexed and enthralling past. So that begs the question, to what extent does your book actually confirm or perhaps challenge, or both to some extent or degree, the established historiographical canon of the period in question?
I think it's more of a challenge than a confirm. It was very much written, as I say, you know, you could challenge it as being overly squint-eyed, but it was very much written against the narrative of inexorable progress that, you know, this is a glorious revolution that ends our period. You know, this has been a sort of 100 years moving in a direction, much of which, you know, isn't new. I mean, you know, whether that was a 19th century Whiggish view or a sort of Marxist interpretation of the 1970s, you know, I mean, a lot of you know, political revisionism that really dominated the field in the 1980s was against those kind of very teleological views of this as being the great century of liberty. But I suppose what I was trying to do maybe was two things. I mean, I was trying to, we're all products of the history that we're brought up in. And at the time that I was an undergraduate, probably the revisionist backlash against those kind of teleological and quite anachronistic often interpretations was probably at its height. So everything was framed in terms of contingency and fragility and the absence of grand narrative. But I think, and that resulted in a sort of hugely productive explosion of really often quite localist, small scale studies to really try and understand, say, allegiance during the Civil War. But it did sort of mean that the historians didn't really produce sort of a big view, that one of the sort of casualties of endless kind of caveats or judicious sort of reframings was a coherent and ambitious narrative. So what I wanted to do was think about the whole century without losing that sense of instability and contingency and precarity. You know, that period of, I don't know, 2 weeks in the end of 1659, 1660, where basically, there is no government in control in London, as you know, sort of in the wake of the collapse succession of republican regimes that followed Richard Cromwell's fall before the Restoration. You know, there are real moments of acute instability when it would have been very difficult for anyone to say with confidence what, you know, what the political regime would look like in a week's time or a year's time. And I wanted to sort of capture both that sense of instability, but also think about how contemporaries themselves interpreted current events in the light of past events, because, you know, contemporaries did always instinctively reach for moments in the past to try and interpret the present in all the instability around the Popish plot in the late 1670s and 1680s. The fear of renewed civil war meant that the slogan, it's 41 is come again, that 1641 and the outbreak of the Irish Rebellion that later became a precursor of the civil wars, a feeling that England had reached that moment of sort of heightened instability again. So contemporaries are always sort of reaching backwards to find events in the past to explain the present. So yes, I think it does challenge the established historiographical canon of the period.
Well, that concludes all the serious questions, and a serious question that was, so thank you. Here's my slight silly curveball, but one I always ask my students and they always ask me. So if you want to dodge this one, Claire, you're more than welcome to do so. But here it is. Here's the scenario. You're hosting a historical dinner party and you can invite anybody that features in your book, or maybe not in your book, but from the period 1588 to 1688, to your dinner party. Who do you invite from that period and why?
Just one guest, or am I thinking of...
I'm afraid you can only have one guest. It's going to be a very parochial, small scale on a budget dinner party. So who do you invite?
It seems so obvious, but on the other hand, if you actually wanted your dinner party to go well,
which always helps.
Yeah, which always helps. And I did write a short biography of him for the Penguin Monarch series. So Charles II. And I also grew up, I also sort of saw my son grow up knowing him as the party king from Horrible Histories. So my instinct would be to invite Charles II, but I would absolutely want to sit him next to somebody not from the 17th century. and I think, yeah, I could think of quite a few people for whom he'd be excellent company.
Brilliant. And you certainly don't want to sit him next to one of the regicides, I guess, because that would be pretty explosive.
or some sort of very serious Puritan. I don't really think that.
I think there'd be a queue of people trying to not sit next to the very serious Puritan at a dinner party. But you never know. You never know. Claire, thank you very, very much indeed. And all the best with your new book, Devil Land, England Under Siege, 1588 to 1688, and with the Wolfson History Prize too. It's been a delight having you with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.